Well, Brad Bumstead, welcome to Newsworks Tonight. You're a veteran State House reporter. You're going to write a book with some of your favorite recollections. Why focus on corruption?
Well, it's been basically what I've done every day, virtually every day, for most of the past 6 years, more so than covering budgets, taxation, other issues. I've been going to the Dauphin County Courthouse or District Justice's offices to cover preliminary hearings on corruption cases involving legislators. There were 38 people with ties to the state capitol charged over the past since 2009, and that wasn't all here. Some of those were federal cases, and some were local cases. There was actually the one involving a former Supreme Court Justice, Joan Ory Melvin, and her sister, a state senator, Jane Ory, were done in Allegheny County. But I was still writing about those from here.
You're right that this is not new. Some of the folks memorialized in statues in the state capitol themselves were involved in corruption.
Well, that's right. Two of the most corrupt political bosses of the late 1800s, early 1900s, Matthew Quay and Boise Penrose, are here memorialized. Penrose, there's a statue of him in the park right next to the state capitol on state grounds between the capitol and the Strawberry Square Mall, an office building. And Matthew Quay is portrayed in a marble, not statue, but it's an engraving, I guess, on the wall as you're leading up the stairs to the Senate chamber. And both of these guys were shakedown artists of one form or another, and notorious people that basically did some of the same things, laid the groundwork for things done today. But I mentioned that in the book because the Capitol itself was involved in a corruption scandal called a Capitol graft scandal in the early 1900s, where the furnishings for this building were $4 million over budget. I mean, just out of the blue, we find out it's $4 million more, and there were numerous people indicted for that, and five people were convicted. Only one or two did jail time for it, but one was the architect, Joseph Houston. So the building itself was a monument to corruption.
And those indictments and charges were how long ago?
Oh, that was over 110 years ago.
All right, so this is an old story. A lot of what you describe in the book goes back to the 1980s, from the 80s right through the 90s, right through the current decade. Do you have a favorite story you love to tell people about Pennsylvania corruption?
Yeah, I think that the most bizarre case involves three sisters being charged with felonies of government corruption. And that is the case of ex-Supreme Court Justice Joan Ory Melvin, her sister Jane Ory, and Jeanine Ory, who was the aide to Ory Melvin in the court. And basically what this involved was Jane Ory using her Senate staff and facilities to help Joan Ory Melvin become a Supreme Court Justice while she was on Superior Court. And it's typical of the kind of cases we saw here, except it was a much smaller dollar amount, but just the fact that it was three sisters and from a very close-knit Pittsburgh political family, actually Pittsburgh suburbs, and it's just amazing. I call it in my book, the chapter on the Orys, the family tragedy, because it not only involved their three lives being turned upside down with these criminal charges, but during the midst of this, another sister of theirs died, who was a physician. She died from cancer, and the brother at one point was in danger of losing his house. So that didn't happen ultimately, but you know, it was just such a chaotic period, and it's a favorite, not because I think it's funny or great in the sense that you might have a favorite, but it's very sad.
In this book, you have a litany of public officials who are hauled away on corruption charges. And these are guys that you and your fellow reporters talk to all the time, them and their staff. And I'm wondering, can you tell me one of these folks who you were shocked to hear that they were committing crimes?
Yeah.
And one that you said, hey, I could see this coming.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I hate to keep going back to the Ory sisters, but Jane Ory is one who, if someone had told me, you know, pick a list of 10 people in the legislature you think will not ever be indicted or run in trouble with the law, she would be one. But there was another guy, a state rep from York by the name of Steve Stettler, and he was charged in one of the latter cases that came up by the Attorney General's office with refusing to turn down an offer to go to private services for campaign work. So basically, it was a negative almost that he was charged for. And by all means, according to most people I've talked to, he, you know, was somebody who you just would not expect to get involved in that, and people were shocked by it that knew him.
Give us an example of someone who, once they were charged, you thought, I could see this coming.
Well, to some extent, former Senator Vince Fumo, partly because he had been charged with a crime before and acquitted back in the 80s, and because there were rumors about this investigation that was going on for a long period, 4 years, I guess, by the feds that they were looking at him, and finally came out with this massive indictment of him misusing money, both state tax money and money that was of a nonprofit in Philadelphia that he had founded and gave state tax money to, as well as a seaport museum that he basically used that for his own purposes and had people working on his property and doing various other sorts of jobs on his behalf.
The 2005 pay raise that was voted in the legislature was a seminal event in kind of integrity in the legislature. You describe being at the meeting at which this was decided upon and right. The degree of public debate and disclosure that the leaders offered. Tell us that part of it.
Well, there was none in terms of disclosure. It was brought up by bill number. It was approved. All we knew is that it was a pay raise. We didn't know how much. We didn't know the amount. And this was at close to midnight on the night that it happened.
So there's no copies of the bill. There is no debate. There is no information. And then when you go to the leaders and say, okay, what exactly did you approve?
Well, they all ran away and basically hustled away from us. The only person who stopped and talked to us briefly was former Senator Bob Mello, who is in federal prison now on charges that he used used public resources for campaigns. And, you know, he stopped and talked to us briefly and explained it. But it was a very complicated bill. And when we finally did get the bill about 1:30 in the morning, you know, it didn't say, you know, here are the various levels of salary. It just said this one goes from this to this. It was very hard to figure out. And it took time. But, you know, we were just provided this at the very last minute after the fact. So even when it comes up on the floor, there was no debate. It was just rammed through, and there had been no committee hearings, no public input, and despite there having been rumors for a week or two, and despite former Democratic Governor Ed Rendell encouraging it at one point, he'd basically thrown it out there as bait to try to get some of the social programs approved that he wanted, and things just blew up after that pay raise.
The reaction to the pay raise was overwhelming. A lot of legislators were voted out of office. The leadership changed in significant measure. There were some changes to legislative procedure. Is it a better legislature now?
Marginally. I'd say that it's better. Let me take that back. I'd say it's to some degree, it really is better because some of the people who were the problem are gone. And part of that is that when you have leaders in office so long, as long as many of these were here, whether that's Fumo, whether that's John Purcell, whether that's Bill DeWeese, they've just been in for decades. And I think that, you know, is part of what's at issue here in a leadership-driven General Assembly. That amount of time just gives them the belief that they can do pretty much whatever they want.
Many of us who cover government write corruption stories. I mean, we love them. They get people talking. They generate outrage. But I wonder, do you ever worry that when we write so many of these, we contribute to the belief that everybody in government is corrupt, is on the take? Do we breed cynicism that way? Do we give an unfair picture of what's going on in the Capitol?
Well, we may or we may not, but, you know, that can't be avoided. I mean, what are you going to do, ignore the corruption that takes place just because somebody might become jaded? I mean, you can't. We really have no choice. We have to report it. At least that's my view. And people are smarter than we sometimes give them credit for in the media, and they will find other sources. They will see, you know, there are some good legislators out there as well, and not judge everybody by what John Purcell and Vince Fumo did.
Is Pennsylvania worse than other states in the area of corruption?
There's really no objective way to measure that, because there are federal public corruption statistics available. When you look at those, they don't count cases like those prosecuted by the Attorney General's office or by district attorneys in Pennsylvania. So who knows? But after the Rod Blagojevich was charged and convicted in Illinois, numerous newspapers took an in-depth look at it. We looked at it as well. And most people, you know, believe that Illinois, which had four consecutive governors go to prison, is probably the most corrupt state. New York has certainly had, you know, a history of scandals, including bribery scandals in the Senate up there now. Historically, New Jersey and Louisiana were always involved, but Pennsylvania would be up there among the top five.
At the end of the book, you ask a bunch of folks who follow these issues for three ideas that would help address this problem. What were some of the best ones you heard?
Term limits. And I have to say, Dave, that for years I always thought that was a stupid idea, you know, to throw good legislators out with bad ones. But the more I looked at it, and these are some of the recommendations in that chapter, it seems like, you know, the problem here was the entrenched leaders that we had. And maybe you have to have term limits for leaders, at least, if not, you know, for the whole chamber, at least for leadership. Another one is initiative and referendum. Well, we see the problems that leads to in California with wacky things put on the ballot. But here in Pennsylvania, citizens have no recourse to vote someone out of office, and we certainly can't put things on the ballot like they can in some Western states. So those are two of those that ought to be at least considered or get some debate.
Early in the book, you recount a conversation with a reporter who'd spent time covering some horrific examples of corruption to the point of murder in Latin America, and you felt like you learned something from it. Tell us about that.
It did. It was as I was contemplating writing this book on corruption, and it was looking for some way to put it in perspective, you know, what we'd seen in Pennsylvania, which was, you know, basically using taxpayers' money for campaigns. And a friend stopped by my house, and he had worked in Central America for Reuters for years. He'd been in Colombia, and he asked, he said, "What's this stuff that I'm hearing about corruption here and FUMO and the House Democrats? What's going on with that?" And I told him, and he said, "Well, you know," he started telling me about some of the cases that he covered in Colombia, which included cops being mowed down by drug dealers and you know, just horrific political murders that take place before, quote, elections, unquote. And, you know, at one point he said that, you know, some of the corruption he'd seen in Central America would make Vince Fumo look like Mr. Rogers. And I just thought that he put it in perspective. Look, it's not what we've seen here is not the worst thing that people can do. And as he put it, at least it is a step towards, you know, resolving these kind of issues, finding the people who are, you know, crossing the line, and that's maybe what separates us from other countries where they don't respect any laws whatsoever.
The name of the book is Keystone Corruption, A Pennsylvania Insider's View of a State Gone Wrong. Brad Bumstead, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much, Dave. I appreciate it.